Today on The Grave Talks, paranormal detective Greg Lawson.
Let me feel safe in my own skin. You hear me crying out when I'm silent. And nobody knows my stories like you do. Cause you help me write them, you were in it too. You make me feel like I'll be alright then. Alright then.
Greg Lawson has been involved in the world of professional law enforcement and investigation work for decades. Being able to view the world of the paranormal through a filter of a law enforcement professional gives him a very unique perspective. How often does the world of paranormal and mental health collide? Are the dead often involved in crimes and criminal investigations, even tragedies? Today, we hear about life from the perspective of the paranormal detective, Greg Lawson.
I was 5 years old. And my brother, who was 12 years older than I was, I had a motorcycle. So he was 17, and he would take me on this little motorcycle on the back roads of Central Texas, and we would just drive around and look for old buildings, old structures, and cemeteries. And then he would take me around and basically just scare the crap out of me, right? We'd go to a cemetery, one specific cemetery that is my first memory of paranormal, so to say, is Middle Fistville Cemetery in Austin, Texas, or North Austin. And we pulled up on the motorcycle, you know, we got out. And then typically, in his typical fashion, he would go around and read the tombstones, and he would read the names and the dates and stuff like that, and then he'd figure out how old the person was. So his goal was to go into the cemetery and find the graves of children my age or younger, and then scare me, you know. And so it started like that. Shortly after that, I was going to watch Frankenstein on TV. It was going to be on TV, and I'm going to watch Frankenstein. Well, my mom said, no, you're not going to watch Frankenstein. You're going to go to bed. And I threw a fit. You know, I cried, and she says, okay, you want to watch Frankenstein? Let's watch Frankenstein. So she sets the TV up, you know, and back then, this would have been 1970, I guess, 1968, 70, something like that. And she goes in and makes the Jiffy Pop popcorn, you know, in the little metal tin, the old style, yep. You know, where it blows up like a big hat. And I remember she gave me Jiffy Pop popcorn and some sort of orange soda, probably Orange Crush. Mm-hmm. And I sat and I watched Frankenstein, and it terrified me, right? And that night I had the terrifying dream of the blonde lady coming to get me. I'm not sure where the blonde lady came from, but anyway, it was kind of like a old hag experience. You know, I'm a little kid, and mm-hmm. this thing is on top of me, holding me down in the bed, and I'm trying to get up, you know, and so that's kind of where it all started. I was about 5 years old, and It for me, it was just natural. Growing up in elementary school, what did I do? I went and got my friends, and I would go, hey, let's go find the cemetery. Hey, let's go find the, you know, do urban exploration, go through old buildings, go through, you know, anything odd or weird. Mm-hmm. But that was my normal. So
sure. I understand. I think I did a lot of the same things as far as getting out there. And I personally would wander around a cemetery. I'm a child who grew up in the 80s and Ghostbusters was quite big. So I would have my proton pack on and I'd be wandering around the local cemetery busting ghosts.
That's awesome.
While these individuals are grieving over, you know, Aunt Bernice. You know, it's like, I got Bernice. Yeah. And they're like, get back here, you little. Yeah. So I understand. It was normal. It's only like years later you look back and go, oh, that was kind of odd. So it very interesting. A lot of this, it sounds like, initially was based on, you know, on paranormal fantasy, on pop culture of movies and things of that nature, and the spooky idea and the feeling that ghosts gave you, or visiting environments that had a spooky lore to them.
That's very true, and to compile on that is I was raised Catholic. So I have this this credo that I was raised with that is, if you look at it, is pretty terrifying. And my godmother sent me the Sacred Heart picture of Jesus. If you've never seen it, go online, Sacred Heart picture of Jesus, look it up. And it's Ted Nugent with his heart hanging out of his chest. That's what it is to a little kid, you know. I had this painting on my wall in my bedroom of this dude with long hair and his heart hanging out. And man, that thing, you know, and his eyes followed you, you know, wherever you went.
Sure.
It was absolutely terrifying. So, you know, as a child growing up, you're told what your reality is.
Mm-hmm.
And your experiences, you know, kind of add to that. But, you know, that's why I affectionately say this. It'll probably be on my tombstone. It'll probably say Catholic, you know, but I consider myself a recovering Catholic. So
I understand. Yeah. I mean, so you have these experiences and you just naturally kind of feel this excitement, this joy. You're drawn to this topic, this idea. Was it real for you as far as maybe ghosts really do exist at that moment, even though you really didn't have a paranormal experience at that moment in time? Or was it more so, I'm curious if this exists and I don't really care if it does or not. I just like the feeling of being spooked out.
You know, it's a little bit of all of that.
Yeah.
I sit back and think about, you know, what I was taught, you know, like the Ten Commandments and, you know, as a child, you assume that other people believe what you believe because that's your belief, and you don't, you know, have that much experience in other people's opinions and all that. But that kind of guides your interpretation of the world, I guess, and you get that through your five senses, you know, touch, taste, hearing, smell, and sight, and maybe you know, a sixth sense, like a your internal clock sense of time or your intuition about how things make you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it can be a very confusing thing. And I firmly believe there's something else. And I do that. I'm a scientific materialist. I've been in law enforcement 28 years or something like that. And so I operate on a level of, you know, I want some fact here that can lead me to getting an indictment through a grand jury. So that's the way I look at the paranormal, is what is some really compelling evidence that something is happening. And you know, the funny thing is a lot of paranormal investigators, a lot of ghost hunters, they go in with a specific thing in mind, and they follow that track as opposed to following the real evidence and interpreting the real evidence. And so I that's kind of where I come from. I believe that if you're investigating the paranormal, how can you use normal means to do so?
Mm-hmm.
We're looking for paranormal, other than normal, something different. And so if we're using gadgetry that is detecting certain things, well, that's normal. So maybe we're already equipped with our brains and our experience, our soul, our spirit, whatever it is, to interpret this stuff. And I travel all over Europe and all over the United States, and I do different ghost tours and I do ghost hunts, and I, you know, I'm on the lecture circuit, and I watch people fly to, let's say, Britain, and they spend a lot of money to stay at really cool places, and they spend 90% of their time looking at their phone or their gadget while they're walking around in the dark in some, you know, castle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, put your gadgets down, have the experience, let yourself have that experience, let your mind, you know, your eyes and your ears and everything be a part of it, not just you know, whether the light turns green or not. So
let's go back to your childhood, or wherever this may fall in your timeline, of where you actually did have an initial run-in with something that, in fact, you look back on and go, maybe that was paranormal, or maybe you're quite sure it was paranormal. You're like, damn, that was paranormal. What was that for you?
So the first thing would be, in my opinion, it's paranormal.
Sure.
It's I saw a Thunderbird, I guess. I saw a giant bird, and I was, once again, I'm 5 years old. I'm across the street playing with a friend. We're under this huge, beautiful weeping willow tree, and we're playing, doing something, and I had to go back home. And so I walk away. My friend goes inside his house. I'm walking across his yard. I walk down this little hill to the street. I step out on the street from underneath that weeping willow, and a bird flew over me, kind of swooped and flew over me, and his wingspan was the span of the road. And it's, you know, like a regular two-lane asphalt road.
Yeah.
And it scared the, you know, everything out of me. It was terrifying. And I ran and I ran and told my mom, and my mom's like, oh no, it's just probably a buzzard. I know, I remember this, and I talked to my mom. My mom passed last year, and I had talked to her a few years ago about it, and she's like, yeah, I remember when you did that, because I was so scared. And she tried to, you know, calm me down and made me a little sandwich, and, you know, but I was really freaked out. And so she remembered that also. And in my mind, in this 5 year old's mind, you know, my perception could have been off. You know, as a child, it's, you know, spatial time and all that. It could have been off, but it was vivid to me how big he was and what he looked like. It wasn't like a buzzard. It was more like a big hawk, you know, like a big eagle. And it could have been an eagle. There are eagles, believe it or not, in Texas, and they're a little west of where I live, about 20 miles. I guess one could have made it over there then and just been really rare. But anyway, it was huge. Mm-hmm. It scared the heck out of me.
It's interesting when you have those experiences as a child, and then you try and review them as an adult. And I know our memory can be very inaccurate as far as how we recall things. You're essentially rebuilding it every time you're recalling it. And sometimes that can be very fallible. But
yes,
sometimes yes. We just, you know, you just know what you saw.
Yeah. And it's interesting you bring that up, because a lot of people really don't understand our senses. I mean, we know, okay, I hear, I feel, I smell, I can taste, and I can see. But there's a lot more to it than that. And the simple fact is, for instance, just to go down this rabbit trail for a second.
Yeah.
For instance, we're all blind. We really don't see. People are like, well, I can see what's in front of me right now. No, you don't. The way your eye is constructed, it's constructed of rods and cones, and all it's designed to do is pick up the electromagnetic spectrum. And that's a huge spectrum, and the only part we can see is the visual spectrum right in the center, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is I'm taking in this electromagnetic spectrum into these senses we call eyeballs, and then it's transformed into electrical and chemical responses, and it goes to the back of my brain, and the back of my brain receives it and then has to interpret what it believes it sees. So you're exactly right. Every time you see something, every time you experience something, your brain is constructing that as kind of an icon on how to navigate your environment. And I'm sitting in front, you know, I'm sitting at a desk, and it looks, you know, wood. I interpret it as wood. It's hard. I can't put my hand through it. That's the way I interpret it. It's very similar to an icon on a desktop. You know, that icon on your desktop is not Microsoft Word. It's an icon to go into a whole bunch of ones and zeros that are formed in a way that can make an interpretation of what you're trying to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really neat. If you sit and think about that for a minute and think that, you know, I believe what I see in front of me is a microphone and a computer. But what's really there, you know, I don't know whether the eyes are a lens to the soul. It's there's a lot of interpretation going on in our brain right now when we're trying to do this. And, you know, pareidolia goes in there, you know, where your visual perception picks up patterns where no patterns exist. But we're designed to do that for fight or flight and for survival, to recognize what is danger and what's friendly. So yeah, it gets really confusing, especially for witnesses or quote unquote experiencers of some sort of paranormal event. It gets really weird for you.
When an individual has a paranormal experience, and let's say there's a group of people out there and a handful or just a few in the group, maybe one in the group said, you know, swears to God they saw something in great detail. Some of the others in the group, they didn't see it, but they heard something and saw something move that seemed to be in tandem with the clear entity or object there that was moving around, and others felt odd, and then some felt absolutely nothing. When you have that, do you believe it's just like our other senses? Some of us can pick up on certain frequencies audibly better than others, just, you know, like our pets can do such things. Do you believe us as humans are in that same sort of a boat where some of us are more sensitive in that area to see things and to sense things that are of what we would call and consider the paranormal, when really they're truly part of our environment? It really is normal. It's paranormal because not very few people are in that spectrum, but that is really what is going on here. Some are just more sensitive to it than others.
Absolutely. Yes. The answer to that question for me is yes.
Yeah.
I've been around a whole bunch of different people. I worked as a homicide investigator, as a hostage negotiator, and as a mental health officer that investigates people that have strange experiences and determines whether or not they need to go to, you know, a mental hospital or not. So I have more than the average person's experience in dealing with those types of things. And you know, it's pretty apparent that there are people that are much more in tuned to their intuition or their gut instinct or, you know, whatever the thing is that they interpret gives them information above and beyond what everybody else gets and interprets it above and beyond what the average person would do. And the problem with a lot of that is we're our own worst enemy. We can trick ourselves better than anybody else can trick us. And the individuals, you know, I've had plenty of people say, oh, you know, have you ever seen a ghost? And I'm like, no, I don't think I have. Like, well, you're just probably not open to the experience. I'm like, well, I've been running around doing this for 50 years. So, man, I suck. You know, it's like, I've ran into some really interesting experiences. I was over in Ireland. We went to Lepp Castle in Ireland, and Dave Schrader of the Halser Files was with us.
Sure.
And we had this great experience. We go in, and I write about this experience in my latest book, The Diaries of the Paranormalist. We went to Lepp Castle. Let me back up just a second real quick.
Yeah.
We're driving around in Ireland. I'm with this little group, and we're just having a good time driving around. And they're like, hey, let's go to Lepp Castle. And I was like, hey, what's Lepp Castle? And the place went silent. And everybody turned around to me like I was the biggest idiot in the room, you know? And they're like, you don't know what Lepp Castle is? I was like, no, I've never heard of it. And they're like, you're in, I use air quotes again, the paranormal detective, and you don't even know what Lepp Castle is? You know, what kind of qualifications do you have? And I was like, oh, I just don't know about Lepp Castle. I don't know. Lepp Castle was the most incredible experience I've had. Going there and meeting the owners and, you know, just letting us go into their house, their home, and go wherever we wanted to go. And I spent probably about 90% of my time in the Bloody Chapel in the top of the of Lepp Castle itself. And there was plenty of murders there. I mean, it was just the craziness that happened there was just beyond. They were all serial killers. All those people were serial killers, and it's just incredible. Anyway, so I spent all this time up there, and I took a whole bunch of pictures. I got pictures of me standing there with hundreds of orbs all around me. And, you know, people are amazed by that. And I'm like, yeah, I would be amazed too. But that was one of the most dusty places on the planet. So, you know, I was stationed in the Sinai Desert for 6 months. So I am qualified to say that.
Sure.
So we get through, and then we go down and talk to Sean, the owner. And he's a musician. He plays a song for us, tells us a couple of the ghost stories there. And then we leave. We walk out. We're walking across the lawn. Everybody's taking pictures, having a great time. Turned around, took a picture. And a friend of mine, Tammy Cody, was standing there. And she took a picture of me, Dave, and Eric. And we left. Well, a couple of days later, we're all looking at the photo and was like, what in the world is that? And up in the second story window, it looks like a priest or a bishop standing in that window. And we had just come down from there. And one of the legends there, well, it's not a legend. This is pretty much historical fact that a brother killed his other brother there in the Bloody Chapel, and the brother that was murdered was the priest for the Klan, not KKK Klan.
Sure.
I'm talking about the Klan over there.
Yeah,
their family Klan. And so, you know, I looked at this picture. I'm like, that is why I spend thousands of dollars to go do stuff. Is just this one little hint of something different, something paranormal, something metaphysical, whatever it is. And anyway, so that's I absolutely have my fingers crossed and believe that there's something else at work around us.
I mean, that sounds like a great experience as far as getting some validation for you know, the adventure or the hunt to see what was over there and to see if there was in fact something in the castle. Obviously, many, many people have their evidence, but it is one thing when you go in yourself and see it and experience it firsthand. Let me go back a little bit and let's talk about your work as a professional with the mental health field and investigating situations there. What sort of situations would you run into where an individual claimed to have a paranormal experience? And this is kind of a and or the other, or really let's hear both sides of this, where you believed, yes, in fact, they legitimately had a paranormal experience. Others are looking at this as a mental health problem. And then what were some of the experiences where they claimed, but then upon further investigation, no, you really should get some help for whatever is going on?
Well, you know, we get mental health units or like critical, what's typically called a critical incident team, is a group of cops. They don't wear uniforms typically, and they get called out on anybody who's committing or threatening to commit suicide or having delusions or ideations of something that is absolutely not normal. And so this typically comes in the form of some sort of disturbance happening someplace. Cops get called there. They get there. They realize this person is having cognitive issues, and then they call a CIT member. CIT member comes out and then interviews the person and determines whether they meet criteria, which is, are they suffering from some sort of mental illness and are they a danger to themselves or others? And if you answer that, then you basically put them in protective custody, take them to somebody to evaluate. Well, you know, these things can fall into kind of their own categories. So you have your alien abduction, alien experience, UFO kind of category. You have your demonic category, and you have some sort of, let's say, intelligence agency category, like the FBI, CIA, NAS, you know, whatever it might be that this person's having a delusion about. So you get called out there. Now, the most compelling ones that I ever worked were the alien abduction the alien abductions situations. And you go out and talk to somebody, and, you know, the stories range from, it has a very broad range. But there's certain characteristics of the story that everybody has. And that would be, you know, bright light, lots of pain. They're experimenting on your body, sticking things in your body, and that sort of thing. And being on a spaceship, not being able to move. They can look around and see some things, but, you know, it's all kind of foggy. I've always taken those reports pretty seriously, because you really don't know what's happening. That could have been somebody drugged them at the bar and took them back to their basement someplace and had their way with them and then dumped them where we found them.
Sure.
Or whatever. So, you know, people, I was helping out, and most of the investigations that I do, I'm very selective about it. You know, in law enforcement, if you're a detective and you work GAD detail, general assignments detail, you're going to get cases like, you know, slashed tires with no suspect information. You know, a damaged mailbox with no leads of who might have done it. And, you know, just a whole bunch of little things, right? And you can take 70 cases like that a month and effectively, you know, contact the victim and say, hey, do you have any other information? Okay, well, I don't have any information. I don't see anything that correlates in your neighborhood that this was an ongoing thing. It looks like it's isolated. You know, if we come up with something, we'll call you back. Otherwise, I'm going to suspend the case. And you suspend the case, you move on. I listen to paranormal investigators that will sit and say, yeah, you know, I've done 700 ghost investigations. And I'm thinking, what? How in the world did you do that? I might do two a year, but in those two, I'm working with people who, one, don't want to be on camera. They don't want to have, you know, any publicity. They work in government, or they own their own business, or they're active in their church, and they just don't want to have anything else, you know, to look down upon them. They don't want that, because that's the way a lot of people look at it. If you say, yeah, you know, I have a ghost in my house, people just kind of roll their eyes and like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe you need some medication. My point is, just because somebody needs medication, just because someone is diagnosed with a mental illness, that doesn't mean they weren't abducted. Mm-hmm. So when you're doing an investigation, when I'm doing an investigation, or dealing with someone who has mental illness and reporting an alien abduction, well, you can't just roll your eyes and go, yeah, this guy's crazy, you know, let's take him to the hospital. You need to follow that trail a little bit and see if something actually did happen. And when we're doing our investigations like that, today, it's a little bit simpler today because of cell phones and because of cameras and that sort of thing everywhere. You know, if somebody's downtown and they said that they had this, well, there's going to be multiple cameras that they walk by in different areas. And, you know, you can support their assertions of what happened, or you can dismiss their assertions of what happened based on what you pull off of their cell phone, what you can get off of video, and of course, you know, third party witnesses and things like that. So, yeah, those are the big ones that really intrigue me the most. The ones dealing with demonology and possession, I dealt with quite a few of those. Quite a few of those were drug induced. Mm-hmm. And once again, okay, just because somebody took drugs, does that mean that they're not, you know, possessed? Well, maybe that's what made them take the drugs, to, you know, because they were possessed and they're making really poor life choices at that point. So, you know, you have to look at that kind of stuff. And of course, then, you know, like I said, the CIA, FBI kind of thing of, I worked one time that, I was talking to this guy and he wasn't really a danger to himself, but he believed that the CIA was watching him and had put, these little robots on his dog. So I go and look at his dog and we're looking for the robots. And sure enough, there's a whole bunch of little creatures crawling around on his dog. They're called fleas, but you know, his interpretation was, well, yeah, they look like fleas, but they're actually robots. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, okay. So, I felt really bad about it because I had talked to a lot of his family and some of his friends, and they said, yeah, he's always believed that. That's what's going on. You know, that's just him. He exists like this, and it's fine. And so he's not a danger, you know. About a month later, we get a call, and he ended up, not treating his dog well because of these robots. And so, you know, there are actions that people will take above and beyond based on their gut feeling or their interpretation on something that, you know, can be flawed.
That wraps up part one of our interview and conversation with Greg Lawson, the paranormal detective. In part two, we'll ask Greg what sort of evidence Greg has come across when investigating claims of the paranormal and mental health problems. How does modern unknown culture influence what people assign as their paranormal experiences? Does Greg believe that any specific category or organization of building or structure may hold more paranormal energy than others? And what happened when a family contacted Greg to investigate a case where a family believed their daughter had a very real, imaginary friend? All that and more in part two of our conversation with Greg Lawson, the paranormal detective. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Simply go to patreon.com/thegravetalks to sign up, or thegravetalks.com and follow the links to become a Gravekeeper. $5 a month gets you access to the rest of this conversation and access to all of our conversations throughout the years. Hundreds of them just waiting for you, and advanced access to our episodes months before they're released to the public. Patreon.com/thegravetalks or thegravetalks.com and follow the links. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Let me feel safe in my own skin. Crying out when I'm silent. Ain't nobody knows my stories like you do. Cause you held me right and you were in too old. You make me feel like I'll be alright then. Alright then. I